Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is Family Secrets, the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. You're about to hear from a man we're calling Frank Gold, not his real name. We thought long and hard about whether it was okay to use a pseudonym for a guest on Family Secrets. After all, what we're doing on this podcast is casting light into the shadows, calling everything by its true name. But Frank has a good reason for keeping his identity private, in the name of protecting others. So here's Frank. Insert air quotes.
My family, both sides of the family came to this country around the turn of the last century, early 1900s. So my grandparents were all born in the United States. My parents were born here. I was obviously born here. And my grandparents were, their parents were very prosperous. The people who came here were very hardworking and industrious. My father's father went to college and graduated from college. And my grandparents were all very affluent. But my parents, both of them, were like a regressive generation. Instead of building on the prosperity of their immediate ancestors, both of my parents were like first-generation immigrants. Neither one finished college. My father didn't even go to college. He was intrigued by a wealthy uncle and wanted to just skip to success. And that was really not a good recipe for him. And they got married very young, in their early 20s. And they struggled. You know, they were poor choices and short-sighted choices. And by the time I was born, they were married about 2 or 3 years. We were living in the tri-state area. You know, I remember we lived in like garden apartments, you know, not fancy. And we lived in one place when I was in kindergarten. We moved again. I mean, maybe I was the wrong kid to move a lot because I take a lot in. I'm very aware.
It can be hard to move around a lot as a kid. You can feel kind of unmoored. You become attached to a place, and then through no choice of your own, you leave that place. And Frank's dad kept changing jobs, so it keeps happening for Frank, along with his younger sister and brother. For Frank, this constant moving around forms a key aspect of his character, one that will serve him well later in life. He becomes hyper-aware, with a keen, almost sixth sense about people and places.
I just remember, you know, this awareness of like all these parallel lives, every town has a school or a school district, and you know, every town and school is going through its own sort of, you know, John Hughes-esque high school experience simultaneously in parallel all over Long Island, all over Westchester, all over New Jersey. The same music, the same experience, you're going to the same concerts, but separately. But when you don't move, that's your world. And you think that is your world. Yet when you move at kindergarten and then a third and then a sixth, none of them are your world.
This might be hard to imagine for anyone listening who's, say, under 30. Today, kids grow up with all of this connectivity. They know there are worlds other than their own. And while that connectivity, the way we're attached at the hip to our devices, definitely has a downside, it also has an upside, especially in families in which secrets are pervasive. But back then, when Frank grew up, it was hard to break through that sense of isolation, apartness, aloneness. Your family's world, your town's world, your community's world, that was the whole world, as far as you knew. So Frank's upbringing, while making him hyper-aware, also makes it hard for him to get close to people. Because, after all, relationships don't last, not when you keep moving.
What was their relationship like, your parents?
I wouldn't say it was particularly warm. They've gotten warmer, by the way, and more expressive in their old age than they ever were that I remember growing up. I don't remember a ton of affection. I don't remember hardly any emotional conversation. And I just saw them recently, And it's always light, la-la, superficial stuff. There's no depth. They don't want to talk about heavy things or emotional things that aren't necessarily even heavy. You know, the weather, about what other people are doing. Very little personal conversation ever.
When Frank is in the 9th or 10th grade, the lack of warmth between his parents becomes something else, something harder, murkier. They've moved all over the tri-state area around New York City. And at this point, his father's commuting a pretty sizable distance to work each day, to a better job. He's making more money, but life isn't getting better. In fact, it's getting worse. And the family is pretty isolated because Frank's father has shoved away his own relatives, always because of unspoken, petty grievances.
It went from, you know, some extra time to commute to all of a sudden late nights. Like, things were like chugging along, normal suburban existence, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, you know, my mother's anxious, upset, standing by the window, looking out the window, pacing, and, you know, that creates anxiety in the house. And, you know, we have school the next day, and I am, by the way, at most 15, 16, you know, my sister's like 9, and my brother's in between. He would come home eventually, and they would argue, they would fight. Where were you? What? Why are you home so late? Why didn't you tell me? And that's unsettling to hear, you know, when you're really wide awake in your bedroom, or worse, awakened by stuff like that. And it was a lot fast, and, you know, in a family that doesn't really talk about emotions, it was confusing. And it was the most emotional thing I'd ever experienced, probably up until then. And all I remember looking back is how incessant it got. It seemed like it grew into, I mean, maybe it started off, you know, a day a week, and then it grew into like a constant thing. And there were just these arguments night after night after night, and the yelling and name calling, and it was horrible. And, you know, it's really abusive to have 9-year-olds and 12-year-olds and, you know, sleeping in their bed listening to this. I mean, I know couples have problems, but there's a time and a place, and that was neither. And I remember talking to my mother one day, who's very upset, and saying, you know, why are you guys fighting all the time? And what's going on? Like, why can't you, like, naively, you know, work this out or fate? What's going on? And I remember where I was standing. Like, I remember, she says, well, because there's things going on. And I said, what's going on? And she said, well, what do you think? I said, how the hell do I know what's going on? I'm just listening to you idiots fight all night. Like, enough already. And she says, well, there's another woman. And I didn't know where to go with that. By the way, my guess is if I had really listened to the fights, I probably would have known that by now. And maybe I did know it on some level. But hearing it, especially from, you know, your parent who you never spoke to about anything emotionally or of substance ever anyway, was jarring. And all I remember, you know, is that persisted through high school. I don't remember anything other than that fighting. And then I left to go to college. And I went to college and I didn't think about that for one second, not a minute.
Did you go far away? I mean, did you try?
I sure did.
Yeah, I had a feeling. Yeah.
About 1,500 miles away.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even visit the school. You know, back then you'd get a brochure in the mail and type your application and send it off and cross your fingers.
But was it important to you to get away?
I liked the idea that it was different. And I liked the idea that, you know, that 32 kids in my class, which is about 275 kids, went to one state school. I'm not going to school with 32 people I just spent last, you know, 4+ years with. I liked the idea that no one was going there. I mean, I'm seeing a pattern now. Yeah, it didn't occur to me that I got to get out of here. But I did, and I wanted change, and I wanted new. And I got it. I really did. And what's funny or interesting is I remember going to college and totally compartmentalizing and blocking out these fights and all this horribleness. And I mean, Danny, it was night after night after night after night. It's torture. I mean, you know, it's funny. At one point, I said to my mother when I was still home, "You gotta leave. Why are you doing this? It's not working. Like, get out. Let's get the fuck out of here. Like, what are we doing here?" "I can't. You don't understand. It's complicated."
Let's take a quick break here. There were other family fights going on at the same time. Frank's mother used to fight with her mother on the phone. He would hear the two of them going at it all the time. More anger, more rage that he constantly was overhearing during his childhood and adolescence. He used to want to walk into the kitchen, take the phone out of his mother's hand, and hang it up because he just couldn't take it anymore.
I will say that my mother, who really is not the perpetrator in any of those stories, is the professional victim in a way. Like, how she could have that same conversation with my grandmother countless times for years and years, I'll never understand. And then to get stuck in it's her own funk with my father in that dynamic, it's horrible. And I don't know why she took it, where she felt so powerless. But she obviously did. I don't want to say I resented her for it, but it angered me that she was not stronger.
So now we're talking about you're in college now.
I come home to visit, and my sister and brother still live in the house because they're in high school or middle school, whatever. The same thing's happening. And I think, oh my God, still, every night, he goes to work. It turns dark. She's standing at the door, pacing, upset. Everyone's in their bed. He comes home, and the same two-person play plays out, you know, from 10 to midnight, like it was the first day, like I never left.
Frank's now out of college, and one day he needs to borrow his dad's video camera. This was in the early days of video cameras when they took VHS cassette tapes, the era well before smartphones. So Frank's dad sets out to show Frank how to use the camera. Frank calls this a normalcy moment, you know, like backyard barbecues or shooting hoops or playing board games. Normal, just something any father and son might do.
So in this normalcy moment, I remember him showing it to me and how it works. And he had to put a tape in it. And he had a tape in it, you know, and he's like, "You hit play and you know, and then, you know, you just record and then you can go back." And a video started to play. I think he thought the tape was probably blank. And it was, all I remember is like a kid, like a young boy playing on a lawn. And I saw it for maybe 5 or 10 seconds. He got completely flustered. And so I thought that was blank. Let me see that. And, you know, took a camera and shut it off and fiddled with it and wound and did something. And I thought, whatever, dude, like, so there's something on the tape. Like, it didn't occur to me that it was his or it was a secret or, I mean, I thought, what are you all jumpy about? Like, the reaction seemed odd, and I remembered it.
And you remembered it. It stayed with you.
Yeah, because I think I've developed this thing for, it's not even conscious, I'm very attuned to people's behaviors, patterns, the way they do things or say things, not consciously. I don't have a list, but when you change course, when you're not consistent, when you're speaking oddly or something's out of your pattern, the spidey senses tingle.
I think for people from whom a tremendous secret has been kept, develop a kind of sixth sense, some sense of, there's a heightened sensitivity because you don't know that there's a secret. I mean, that's, it wouldn't be a secret if you knew there was a secret. There's just this feeling of hypervigilance or observing very carefully, the pieces not necessarily totally adding up. And then I think in retrospect, those moments, like the moment with the video cassette, become aha moments. It certainly wasn't an aha moment as you were experiencing it, but later.
Yeah, I filed it away. And by the way, I didn't try to develop the skill. I didn't know I had the skill. I didn't know everyone didn't see and perceive things the way I did. But I now know, you know, that I have a hyper subconscious awareness to patterns, to behaviors. You know, it's funny. You don't want to watch a movie with me because I can spot that formula. There's nothing unintentional in a movie. So everything they say and do that seems meaningless or innocuous is not. It's a plot device. And I'm like, oh, he's going to get locked out of his house. Like when they focus on the keys being, like, there's a reason for all that stuff. And yeah, I think this is the byproduct of this. I mean, my mother told me in part, you know, the one little factoid that she knew, that, you know, this fighting and tumult was, you know, the result of an infidelity. But there was still so much lying and manipulation and emotional abuse happening. And, you know, you sit up, you sit in your bed in the pitch black and you hear it all, and you hear it night after night. And, you know, all of a sudden you're like, I'm hearing inconsistencies in the story. She's not picking up on it because she's sobbing and yelling. But I'm thinking, well, wait, you didn't. That's not what you said 2 nights ago. It's a rough way to develop that skill.
So fast forward into Frank's adult life. He becomes an attorney. His skills as an interpreter of people's patterns and behavior serves him well in his career. He marries, has 3 kids. His parents, still together, incredibly, move to Florida and sort of settle into a calmer life. The violent fights have been reduced to squabbling, but with a mean edge to it. Frank doesn't see them too often.
One day, literally, I'm sitting at my desk, like, life is just normal, and that stuff is very far behind me and very distant in my mind. The phone rings, and it's my sister. And she's like, hey, I need to talk to you. And she said, I got a call, and I don't know what to do with it. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And she's like, well, you know all the stuff we talked about growing up and all the fighting and all that other stuff? I said, yeah. She's like, well, I got a call from our half-brother. And I said, what? Who? I am unaware of a half-brother. I'm like, what are you talking about? She says, well, seems that all those fights and all those late nights, it wasn't just an affair. It blossomed into another family. I said, and there's a son? She says, no, there are two. And I laughed because it's insane news. It's unimaginable. It changes your entire reality in a moment. And it's not even just one. And I needed a moment to just like process, like, okay, let me shut the door and you can tell me, like, what, are you sure? Like, you don't know where to go with something like that. And she told me this story, how this guy, kid called her, and, you know, he's younger than us because he was born when we were in high school. And the short version is, this is the older son. He speaks to my father and sees my father fairly often. And he said to my father one day, you know, you're getting older, and what happens, like, you know, if you were sick or you died, like, how would I know? I'd need to speak to my siblings and find out. And my freaking father's like, yeah, call my daughter because she's the most understanding. I'm like, they didn't think I would understand. They didn't want to call me. By the way, probably picked the right person. But, you know, I went from like stunned and almost laughing to like kind of anger.
So your half-brother calls your sister and introduces himself.
Yes.
With your father's permission?
Yes. But my father does not have the balls to make the call himself. First of all, that's a cowardly move. Your secret half, your secret son wants to speak to his adult half siblings, and you decide with him which one is the best to approach, and then you let him do it? That's offensive. And she's like, you have no idea the conversation I had with this guy. Like, we thought we had it bad. He had the reverse, you know? The times that dad was home, he wasn't there. And that woman who concocted a whole story, see, they didn't know there was another family. They thought he was busy and traveling and at work.
Hold on. So your father, who was pretty ineffective in a variety of ways in life, you know, professionally, that kind of thing.
As average or below, as run-of-the-mill, unexceptional as you get.
Except as someone who managed to have two households, each of which didn't know about the other?
Correct.
How did this half-brother then know that there was another family with other siblings?
He's like a criminal investigator, which I think is hilarious because part of him calling my sister might have been about, you know, just so we're in contact in case something happens to my father. I think the other half, or maybe more than half, was he actually wanted some answers. And I suspect he wasn't getting them from my father. And now, keep in mind, now we're in the age of social media. And it's not hard to find people. And it's not hard to find people with your last name or your proximity, especially if you're a criminal investigator for a police department.
So then what happens, Frank? How do you process? Does your mind go back to that VHS cassette tape?
Absolutely. And it goes back to why he wouldn't stop the behavior. You know, he would lie and connive and promise, but he had a house with two babies. So he's not going to stop. And by the way, my sister explains all this to me and has a lot of details because she spoke to him at length. And I said, this is a huge problem. This is not okay. And I said, first of all, I don't really, I know this kid who called is innocent in this. You know, he didn't choose it. I don't begrudge him wanting to know his full story because he had an even more bizarre, he also lived in a house of lies, just different lies. And maybe they weren't fighting, but he saw his father very, not often, less than we did, ironically. So I don't want to meet him, and I don't want him to be in my life. And I wish he didn't exist. And while I begrudge him nothing, it doesn't work for me. So I said that to her right away. I said, I'm not interested. I'm not talking to him. I'm not meeting him. And my sister said, yeah, me too. I didn't believe her at the time, although I think she's come around to that. And I said, we have to talk to our dad about this. Like, this is not okay. And I thought about it for a long time. And you go through a lot of different feelings, you know, those stages of grief. Truly anger, denial, bargaining. I mean, you really do go through that.
What would you say you were grieving?
I thought those days and those feelings and those scabs were behind me. If not healed, closed at least. And like an alien just showing up, like, I'm telling you, your reality changes in an instant. It's very disorienting to think you know the world today and receive a phone call and find out that humans exist that don't fit with your story, blood relatives, and they're alive and they're, and that's the reality.
It's the difference between, like, the language, like when I found out that my dad hadn't been my biological father, I was describing it as something that happened to me, that I discovered that, you know, that I wasn't who I thought I was, literally. And I realized I had to change the language because it wasn't something that happened to me. It had always been thus. Like, it had, it was me. And that, I think, is part of what's so shocking and disorienting when you uncover a secret like that, because it was the reality. You didn't know it was the reality, but it was for a very long time in your life.
Yes, and I feel betrayed and deceived because of it. And I never trusted people that much. Like, when most people give people trust, and then people can lose that. I don't distrust, but I start out at zero. No one gets credit in advance. And that was formed long before this phone call. The phone call lets me know where it came from, even though it wasn't always conscious.
We're going to pause for a moment for a word from our sponsor. Frank tells his wife the story because, as he puts it, that's what couples in healthy relationships do. But he feels sick about it, embarrassed, as if somehow this reflects poorly on him. And then, after sitting on it for about a week, he calls his father.
I said, "This is not okay. It's not." He says, "Look, life is complicated, and, you know, all I could say is you know, you have needs, you take actions, you do something, and you think it's one thing, and it turns into something else, and all of a sudden you have this." And I said, "Yeah, maybe for one kid. Not two. Two's not an accident. One is like, oh my God, what happened? Two is a family. You know, fool me once. Two? Unforgivable, unacceptable. He's bullshitting me. He's selling me, you know, this whole, hey man, you know, you think it's one thing." No, at some point you were in. When you took that fucking video camera there to film your sons, you knew what you were doing. By that point, it was not unintentional or an accident. So don't tell me that crap. I mean, my whole life and career is about sussing out full of shit people. And he's you know, patient zero in full of shitness for me.
So I'm imagining that conversation, like, doesn't particularly end with some kind of, like, great closure for anybody involved.
No, it doesn't. And I'll tell you how it ends. He says, "Look, you know, your mom, I don't think you should burden her with this, and it would be a lot for her." And I realize my mother, and I'm going to say this intentionally, may not know. He thinks she doesn't know. She may know. She may have a video camera story in her head someplace, or she may not want to know. And I said to him, "Stop. I will talk with her about this or not because of my relationship with her. Don't ask me to do something or not do something, because I'm more likely to do it to spite you. So stop selling me."
And here we arrive at the reason, or at least part of the reason, why Frank is using a pseudonym for this episode. His mom, as far as this part of the story goes, is innocent. Also, his kids. He doesn't want to be the guy who suddenly doesn't speak to his relatives the way his father did. He's refusing to allow his father to turn him into a version of himself who he hates and disrespects. So he doesn't say a word to his mother or his kids.
5 years go by, and Frank's daughter wants to go to Florida to see her grandparents. There's a Pink Floyd concert that Frank wants to see that's happening in Florida at the same time. So he tells her, you know what? I'll come with you for the weekend. We'll see them. I'll go to the show. Then his dad catches wind of it, and he says he wants to go to the show too. He knows the venue, knows all the guys there. At first, Frank recoils, but then...
I thought, again, am I being that guy, you know? Again, I have a reason why I can't see my father, and I don't want to be him, you know? So I think, I'll give it a... How bad can it be? What could go wrong? So we go to this concert, and it's fine. He knows the people at in the parking lot. He knows the ticket takers. Because the guy who thinks he's antisocial is, you know, the schmoozer. He knows everyone. He's connected. And it's a real conflict between, you know, how he describes himself and how he acts. We go to the concert, and there's an intermission. And we decide to go, you know, get some, walk around, go to the bathroom, whatever. And as we're walking up the steps to leave the arena, it's like, oh, this is a client of mine. Some local guy of renown that he knows. He's like, the guy's like, hey, how you doing, man? And my father's like, hey, how you doing? Let me introduce you to my son. And he introduces me, but not by my name, by the older half-brother's name. And he doesn't realize he does it. And he just, and the guy's like, hey, nice to meet you. And they just chit-chat for a minute or two. And I am stunned. Like the arena got quiet, you know, like that device in a movie where it's just you. Like the camera zooms in and everything fades to like a hush. And you're like time stood still. And you're like, where do you go with that? And I thought, another test, you know. And I said to myself, I really consciously thought this. I'm not going to get freaked out by this. I'm not going to let this ruin this night for me. I'm letting this one go. And he says goodbye. The whole transaction is like 2 minutes. And we walk into the arena. And he goes, oh, he's a really nice guy. I said, yeah. And wrong son. He's like, what? I said, I'm Frank. You introduced me by Southern name. And he turned red and he looked bewildered. I've never seen... Maybe the only other time I saw that face was on the video camera, you know, when he was fumbled and confused, you know, the two worlds all of a sudden overlapped, matter and antimatter. And he did, and he looked so embarrassed. I've never seen that expression. He goes, I said, yeah, you did. And anyway, let's go. Oh, no, I mean, he's a great kid. And, you know, you shouldn't be. I mean, I said, stop speaking about it and don't mention it again. Old man. And that's it. And we walked away.
Throughout our conversation, Frank's embarrassment that this is his family. This is his father. This is where he comes from is palpable. He so badly doesn't want this to be his story. He got out. He moved away. He built his own happy, successful life. And then this new piece of information, shameful information, as Frank experiences it, has crashed in like a meteor. And he's now carrying around this story like his own secret. Is this why he doesn't want to tell his kids or talk to his mom about it? Embarrassment? Shame?
First of all, it's not my secret to tell her. It's his. So one, that's my rationalization to get me off the hook now that I know this piece of information that I don't want to, that I don't feel I should even be the one to tell her. And I don't know that she'd want to hear it from me, but I wouldn't want to hurt her. She's the one who never left, and she's the one who still lives with this guy. I don't want to wake the sleepwalker.
So Frank puts this whole story somewhere inside him. Or at least tries to file it away. He doesn't think about these two half-siblings of his. He doesn't want to have anything to do with them. It's not their fault that their father had two families. Intellectually, Frank knows this. But that doesn't matter. Or at least, it doesn't matter enough. So he doesn't think about this all that much, to the point where, when he does one of those over-the-counter DNA tests, it doesn't occur to him that Wait for it.
Guess who showed up in the database? They think you're their half cousins or whatever. And my kids are in there under my account. My sister is in there and her son. I shut it all down. I stopped the sharing. I broke the connection. I did, other than quit the service, I shut anything down that makes a connection or shares information or shows names. I stopped sharing with any relatives or anybody. Because again, the virus showed up again.
Did it occur to you that that might happen, or did that not enter your mind?
I didn't think about it.
That's so interesting.
I never thought about it.
So there's this way, it strikes me, that the way that you have managed to metabolize this and kind of just move on with your life is to just bring down, it's something bigger than a curtain. It's like to bring down a big, thick concrete wall. Like, it doesn't exist. It shouldn't have existed. So therefore, it's not going to exist. So you would have been able to do something like submit your DNA to a commercial testing site and actually not think, hey, wait a minute, there's this world genealogically out there.
That's right.
That could be complicated.
Yes, because it's the same compartmentalizing when I went to college the first time and came home and said, what? This is still happening? But of course it was. I mean, why wouldn't it still be happening?
So in a way, that compartmentalizing has served you well.
I think so.
All right, so I have one more question. So you said before, you said this great thing. You said, I'm glad I know. I wish it didn't exist, but I'm glad I know. Why are you glad you know?
Well, because it's reality.
I'd like to thank Frank for trusting us with his story today. Family Secrets is an iHeartMedia production. Dylan Fagan is the supervising producer, Lowell Brulanti is the audio engineer, and Julie Douglas is the executive producer. If you have a family secret you'd like to share with us, you can get in touch at listenermail@familysecretspodcast.com. And you can also find us on Instagram at Danny Ryder and Facebook at Family Secrets Pod and Twitter at Fam Secrets Pod. For more about my book, Inheritance, visit DannyShapiro.com.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.